So we'll move on to our next case, which is Rennell versus Roe. Mr. Bates.
Good morning, Your Honors. It pleases the Court, Christian Bates on behalf of the appellants. This case involves two members of a limited liability company. It's referred to out the briefing as the joint venture that was created to own and operate mobile housing communities throughout the United States. In November of 2007, one member of that limited liability company, the defendants, Mr. Roe and his entities, sat down the appellant at a regularly scheduled business meeting and told them that they were terminating the joint venture, that the relationship was over, and that the appellees were acquiring the appellant's ownership interest in that company for a very small percentage of what it was worth.
Let me clarify something. As I understand it, the joint venture was terminable for cause, and one of the items that was specified to be cause for termination was the termination of a property management agreement.
Correct, Your Honor.
And then moving down to the property management agreement level, the property management agreements were terminable either with or without cause, and there were provisions that said if you terminate without cause more than 30 days, you have to make certain kinds of extra payments, and if you terminate without cause within a 30-day window, then you had to make more payments. I'm just summarizing. So the property management agreement could be terminated, at which point, you know, the toothpicks all fall apart.
Well, that's a point of contention in this case, Your Honor. We argue in our briefs that the property management agreements could not be terminated without cause.
Say without cause in
these
paragraphs.
Well, if you look at the specific, and we're talking about Section 6.2 of the property management agreement.
Yeah, I did look at it.
There are subparts A through G, which provide very detailed for-cause termination provisions.
And then there are these other two parts that talk about termination without cause.
The notice provisions in subparts H and I say that in the event that the appellee can terminate without cause, here's the procedure. And, of course, our argument is that under A through G, there's nothing in those documents that say, okay, under these circumstances, they can be terminated without cause.
That doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, it's very common that you'll have a without cause provision with a little bit of notice and some cross payments because there was no reason to do it. And with cause is usually the kind of thing you can just do it right away. Sometimes there's a cure period, sometimes there isn't. But I didn't see anything inconsistent in the property management agreements within that paragraph 6.
Well, I would respectfully argue, Your Honor, that if there's the ability to terminate the property management agreements without cause under sections that clearly deal with notice only, then the subparts A through G that deal with cause termination are simply superfluous.
I don't see it, though. Because there are things you have to do that are extra. You have to pay costs to the manager. If there's a without cause termination, you don't have to pay those costs if you terminate with cause. Isn't that a difference?
That is a difference, but again,
and an important one, costs, money.
Well, again, Your Honor, I would argue that those provisions are ambiguous because, again, the H through I provisions, the only reference in there to without cause termination is simply in the event that they have the ability to terminate with cause, they will do X, Y, and Z. That's the only reference to without cause termination in the entire property management agreement. And again, subparts H and I are very clearly labeled notice provisions, whereas subparts A through G, again, are the for-cause termination provisions.
It's just you'll agree, though, that it does use the words without cause.
The words without cause are stated within the notice provisions in H and I.
And if we read it your way, what happens to the meaning of those words?
Well, the other thing, Your Honor, and I think
What happens to the meaning of those words if we read it your way? They just put them in for decoration or what?
Well, we contend that those provisions are in there in error. And what those provisions say is that in the event they have...
I don't understand that. It's a contract.
Well, exactly. But, I mean, the same argument would apply to subparts A through G. And, again,
No, but you're not answering my question. You think that A through G would be superfluous if we read this contract to permit some kinds of termination without cause. And I'm just asking you to turn around. If we ignore the words without cause in those paragraphs, then what have we done to the interpretation of the contract? Virtually every state says you shouldn't rewrite contracts as you interpret them. You need to give every word some meaning if it's at all possible to do so.
And again, I think that the meaning of those words is in the event they have the right to terminate without cause, which would require them to look elsewhere in the property management agreement, then under those procedures they can. But again, there's nothing in the property management agreement that says they can terminate without cause. And I think
so,
that
so let me ask you another question, since I think I have your point on this. The essence of your client's dispute really is that the interest was valued at this $3.5 million level not very long before this termination, and then the other people came to him and said, you know, take it or leave it, we're going to give you $300,000, and so he was really over a barrel. Did he ever, to what extent are you exploring in either this case or any other case, just a simple old breach of contract, you know, you didn't pay us the amount of money that we should have been paid?
We had it filed as part of this case, Your Honor, a breach of contract claims, bad faith claims.
Isn't that really what this case is about, a breach of contract as opposed to RICO?
No, it's not, Your Honor, because this is an extortion case, and it's not only an extortion case.
Well, I know you called it an extortion case, but I'm trying to figure out how to, you know, we have this perennial problem of distinguishing very hard bargaining on the one hand from extortion on the other.
Well, exactly. There's extortion.
How do you define extortion?
Extortion is the taking of property, or the wrongful taking of property by threat of force or harm. In this case, we're dealing with economic harm, Your Honor. And what they told him was is that we're going to give you $280,000 for your $3.5 million interest. And if you don't take it, and we're giving you 24 hours, by the way, to capitulate. If you don't capitulate within 24 hours, you will get nothing, and we will make sure that you never work in this industry again.
Oh, that is not what you alleged in your complaint.
Oh,
that second part is not part of your complaint.
That is in the complaint, Your Honor.
I don't see it.
The part where he alleged that if he did not capitulate within 24 hours, he would get nothing, and he would make sure that he did not work in the industry? About working
all
in the
I
industry?
See in the complaint, maybe I'm wrong, this is paragraph 99, further threatened that if Rennell didn't sign, et cetera, Roe would prevent Rennell from continuing the MH business and industry by publishing to third parties the termination of the relationship. Now, that publishing to third parties the termination of the relationship, what does that mean? I mean, they'd have to tell other people that they terminated the relationship. Anyone who they were dealing with that was affected by the termination, they'd have to tell them, you know, we no longer have a relationship. They'd have to do that, right?
Not necessarily. I mean, these.
Well, I understand. There are people who are dealing with both entities, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're closely entwined in these real estate ventures. So wouldn't it just be the most natural thing for Roe to tell people who were involved with this, well, no, we no longer are working with Rennell?
Well, if that's such a natural consequence, Your Honor, then why make the threat in the first place? Why point out to Mr. Rennell when he's sitting there?
But the only act of threatening that maybe I'm reading your, maybe I'm being too literal-minded, but it seemed to me the only act of threatening that you alleged was this publishing to third parties.
Well, the other threat, of course, would be that if he didn't capitulate, he would receive nothing.
Well, that's true in any contract situation, right? I mean,
he would receive nothing, and then you sue for breach of contract because you say under the contract we were entitled to some positive amount of money.
But we're talking about two members of a limited liability company that owe fiduciary relationships between another.
Well, do you disagree with me that when somebody breaches a contract and doesn't pay monies that are owed, the other party has a claim for breach of contract?
Yeah, but we have a situation here where he's saying that the
so interest. Why does that become is every breach of contract extortion?
The breach of contract, well, the distinction
which
here
breaches
is that
of contract are extortion
the
and
the
which
distinction
aren't.
Here, Judge Wood, is that the breach of contract here involves the taking of my client's property, the
no,
taking
what,
of his
see,
ownership
what makes
interest.
Your, what makes your case uniquely weak is the phrase without cause, because if you enter into a contract with someone who's reserved the right to terminate without cause, you know you're taking a huge risk. You have no protection. So,
but the operating agreement itself does not have without cause terminations. The
but
operating
it incorporates
agreement can only
the
be
property
termination.
Property management agreement, though. So I thought you agreed earlier that we did need to move down to the, if you will, to the property management agreement level.
Correct. In our position, Your Honor, and again, it's important, I think, to understand that this case was decided under a 12B6 motion to dismiss. I think that the discourse between
because
Judge Wood and I demonstrates...
Because the contract is perfectly clear. That's the problem.
I would respectfully disagree, Judge Posner. I believe that this contract is ambiguous as to whether or not it can be terminated without cause. The only reference to without cause termination is in two sections of the property management agreement that clearly state that they are notice provisions only. And it specifies under such circumstances under which the contract can be terminated without cause. There's nothing in that agreement that says under these circumstances they can terminate without cause. If they could terminate without cause under
Why
any
do you have
circumstances,
it in there?
We don't know. And that's what creates the ambiguity. They would still have to point to a circumstance. We have a notice provision that says, if we can terminate without cause, here's what's happened. You still have to answer the question, can we terminate this without cause? Point to something in the property management agreement that says we can terminate this without cause. But again, even if the property management agreements were properly terminable, my client had a right to receive the fair value for his interest. And when Mr. Rowe sat him down and said, you're not going to receive that interest, you're going to receive a paltry...
I don't understand you. I don't understand that. So that means you can't terminate at all.
Well, the contract can be terminated based upon the enumerated events in the contract. But again, even if the contract is terminated, and again, that's sort of a secondary issue.
Is this unjust enrichment? You have a suit for unjust
extortion.
Enrichment? Is that
Your Honor,
what you're talking
in
about?
June of 2000,
is that what you're talking about? Unjust enrichment?
It's not unjust enrichment. It's extortion.
Is that what you're talking about?
I'm not following the question, Your Honor, and I apologize.
Well, usually, if someone is taking your property, that's considered without cause, that's considered unjust enrichment.
And if they're taking that property by threat of harm, that's extortion.
You can sue to get your property back, right?
Correct.
Well, what does that have to do with extortion?
Because again, under these facts and circumstances, and under the Hobbs Act, we've pled a cause of action of extortion.
Well, that's like saying every conversion is extortion. I don't get that.
Well, if there's a threat...
I have a dispute over whether you own your car or your ex-wife owns your car. What is extortion? How does extortion end?
If I go to my ex-wife and say, I'm going to take your car, and if you don't give it to me, I'm going to cause you harm, that's the extortion. Again, the taking of his interest and threatening to do so.
Why doesn't she just sue you for replevin or something, to get the car?
There are many avenues of relief, and we raised 11 counts in this, one of which being the RICO claim. And again,
and your state claims, as I recall, were dismissed without prejudice by the district court.
Because they did not take jurisdiction over the federal claims.
Because of the ruling on the RICO claim. So should... So had you never appealed, you could have, or should this court agree with the district court, those are still
correct. Those
available
claims would still
you.
Remain viable. That is correct.
Okay.
But again, I just want to impress upon the panel, we're talking about a 12B6 motion here to dismiss. We have pled the causes of action for extortion. We have pled the predicate acts under the RICO statute. The court, in dismissing this case, has basically said that in a business context, it is not legally possible for one partner to extort another partner when they can look at some buy-seller put-call right in a limited liability company agreement or an operating agreement or a partnership agreement. And I think it's important, to determine the facts here that in June of 2007, as part of a refinancing with the bank, the Northern Trust in Cleveland, Ohio, the Green Court entities had represented that ownership interest was worth $3.5 million. That was pledged as collateral for a loan. 6 months later, he's saying, you're going to take $280,000. If you don't agree to the $280,000 by tomorrow, you're going to get nothing. And we're going to publish those statements to the third parties. We're going to make sure, we're going to make sure you never work in this industry again. That's the way my client took it. And again, on a 12B6, this is not a summary judgment case. This is a 12B6 motion. We should be afforded the right to move forward because we've met the pleading requirements of the case.
Well, the way your client took that they would never be able to work in the industry again is the way they took it. Did they actually tell your client that?
What they told my client is as alleged in the complaint, Your Honor.
So they said they'd publish it.
They said that they would publish that to third parties, which is what my client understood that to mean, is that they would basically tell others and that he would be ruined and he would never be able to work in this industry again. I see my time is up if there's no further questions.
Mr. Bates. Ms. Nelson.
Good morning, Your Honors. May I please the Court? Christy Nelson on behalf of the defendants. Judge, the district court dismissed without prejudice the plaintiffs' RICO claims and gave them an opportunity to replead.
Well, originally the RICO claims too, right? Gave them an opportunity to replead, and
the district court actually gave the plaintiffs the opportunity to replead the RICO claims. They opted not to, and asked the court to issue a final order so that they could appeal. So I just wanted to make that clear. They were given the opportunity to go back and replead a RICO claim, and they did not take that opportunity.
Judge, so, I mean, to take this, let's say in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs, it does sound like the defendants were taking a pretty heavy-handed approach, statements, you'll never work in the business again if you don't take this 92% reduced value for the business. I mean, is it your view that it's not extortion until they say, and we're also going to shoot off your kneecaps? Or, what does it take to cross the line once such a disproportionate threat has been made?
Well, Judge, first of all, I don't believe that that is the actual allegation in the complaint. The allegation in the complaint was basically that it was a take-it-or-leave-it offer. If you don't take the deal as we're proposing it, then you will get nothing. And then there is a second component, which is that if you don't take the deal, we're going to publish to third parties that our relationship is terminated. There was nothing unlawful or wrongful about either of those threats, and that's what it would require.
Apart from the fact that they might have been a breach of these various contracts.
That is true, Your Honor, and I think this case is...
What's peculiar about the publishing business is, if publishing just, is used in the defamation sense as publicly or actually publishing in defamation law just means communicating something. If that's what it means in the complaint, obviously, as I was saying to your opponent, they'd have, in any event, whether they give them $1 million or $200,000, they'd have to notify the people with whom they're dealing. So
there's nothing improper about
no, but
telling...
isn't the implication of this badly drafted paragraph 29 that they're going to do something special in some sense if Rinnell turns down the deal, right? Because they're always going to communicate the end of their relationship. That's inevitable. That's not what he's... But somehow he's alleging that they're going to... It's going to be some different kind of communication if he turns down the deal.
Well, I don't believe the allegation, even liberally construed, states any wrongful threat that was made. And that's what would be required under
Edmonds. Do you think it would be wrongful if the allegation... more particularly were, not only will you never work with us again, but we will be sure to freeze you out of this industry, this, kind of prefabricated homes, whatever they are, industry forever. We'll tell no lender to do business with you. We will...
If there was a threat to violate a law or engage in any sort of illegal conduct or a threat... That
what
was
if it's just
wrongful,
business
per
defamation,
se?
like the case where the person calls all the people and says, these people aren't doing concerts anymore.
Yeah, the Tobin case. That
yeah,
was
right.
And the court construed that conduct as telephone terrorism. And I suppose there could be cases where it might rise to the level of extortion, but that's certainly not what is alleged here. And I think you have to look at the test that was established in the United States versus Edmonds decision, which requires both a wrongful means and a wrongful objective. And as to the wrongful objective...
Is extortion as a predicate act in RICO, does it have to be criminal?
Yes, it has to be a violation of the Hobbs Act or a state,
it's not
state
just,
law.
It's not just the contract law concept of duress.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in their complaint, they originally did not designate which type of or what extortion law they were saying was violated. It was in the briefs that they fleshed out that they were alleging a Hobbs Act violation. And under the Hobbs Act, in order to be extortion in an economic threat case, which is what this is, there have to be both the economic means and the unlawful means and the unlawful objective. And they can't meet either of those prongs. Because as for the unlawful objective, what was the objective here? The objective was acquiring the Class C membership interests. And as Your Honors have, I believe, correctly construed the contract documents, there was a right to exercise a call right and acquire those Class C membership interests upon the occurrence of a termination event. And one of the termination events under the operating agreement was a termination of the property management agreement. And those documents on their face are clear and unequivocal. And under Section 6.2I of the property management agreement, there was a right to terminate without cause upon written notice.
And you had to pay, right? You had to pay some management fees or something like that?
That's correct. There were certain fees that needed to be paid, and we, in fact, paid those fees. The plaintiff received those fees. It's interesting. They signed the termination documents. They accept all the money that we paid, which was over $300,000, and then they turn around and sue even though they've already signed a release.
Is that a different $300,000 from the one that you...
The amount that they were paid for their Class C membership interest, I believe, was about $290,000, but then they also received some additional consideration as well.
Under 6I?
That's correct.
Okay.
And additional consideration that they were not entitled to under the agreements that provided the consideration for the release that was contained in the termination documents. So they, in addition to... there being no wrongful means, no wrongful objective, they also signed a release of claims, which bars the suit. Now, the district court didn't address that issue, but it is another argument that we've raised in our brief. The termination document that they signed, under which they accepted the $292,000 for their Class C interests, they also received additional consideration to which they were not entitled under the operating agreement or the property management agreement, and they accepted that.
How are those agreements drafted? How did they come into existence? Property management and the other ones.
The operating agreement and property management. I'm sorry, Judge. I don't have an answer to that. I'm not sure who drafted them initially. The contract documents themselves give us the lawful claim of right to acquire the Class C membership interests. That's why they can't establish the wrongfulness of our objective. And then they also have to establish that we used wrongful means in order to obtain the wrongful objective. And in their case, that's where their alleged threats come in. They're saying that we made these threats and that they were wrongful. But as Your Honors have noted, what they've alleged at best is a take-it-or-leave-it offer. If you don't take it, we aren't going to pay you what you're due under the contract. So at best, they're alleging a threat that we're going to breach the contract. That is not illegal or wrongful. And this court has noted in many cases that when a party enters into a contract, they always have the right and the option.
take it or leave it. This money... you offered them. Was this an estimate of what was due them, or was it just a gift to make them go away?
No. It was an estimate, Your Honor, based on the current value of the company and then their portion being the Class C.
If they had disagreed, said, no, that's much too low, what would have happened next?
Well, I don't know how the parties would have acted, but let's just assume their allegations are correct, which we must, and let's just say that the defendants followed through and didn't pay them anything. What would have happened next? They could have filed a breach of contract claim. And that's our point.
What happens with these interests, these Class C interests or whatever, right? You've offered them the money. He says, no, that's too low. Now, what does Roe do? What do you do next?
Did the interest transfer?
Pardon?
Do the interest transfer somehow?
Yes, it was part of our once we terminate when we have the right to terminate, we also have the right to exercise a call right, and that's what we did. We gave notice that we were exercising our call right to purchase the interest. Now, I suppose if he had just failed to sign the necessary documents to transfer to do the assignment, then perhaps we would have had to go to court to try to enforce those provisions. But that's obviously not what happened. When he was presented with the deal, he accepted the deal, signed the agreements, which contained a release, accepted the money, accepted the additional consideration, and then still turned around and sued us with an 11-count complaint.
That make it an extreme case. Suppose you knew that the actual value to which he was entitled under the contract was $500,000, but you also know that, he's on the brink of bankruptcy and can't afford to engage in any litigation. And then you offer them the $250,000 or what have you. Would that be extortion?
I don't believe so, Judge, no. Because you don't have a wrongful objective and you haven't done anything wrongful. You haven't done the wrongful means. Now, that's obviously not what happened here, but I think if you applied the two-step analysis.
Arguably, duress under contract law. But you're saying not Hobbs Act.
Exactly, Judge. And I think that this case is just another example of plaintiffs abusing the RICO Act in a business dispute. They've alleged an 11-count complaint. They have breach of contract. They have breach of fiduciary duty. They have economic duress to try to get themselves out of the release agreement that they signed. I mean, they have all sorts of other counts that they've alleged, and those counts survive. We're not here to argue about those. What we're here to argue about is this a RICO case?
I take it there's no diversity between the parties, or maybe it's because of attorney's fees in RICO?
I'm not sure about the diversity, Your Honor. This is, RICO was passed, as you know, to combat organized long-term criminal activity. I mean, not only have they not alleged a predicate act under the Hobbs Act, they also haven't alleged a pattern of racketeering, which is another independent basis for affirming dismissal.
What's the advantage of bringing it under RICO, as you said? Attorney's fees as judge.
Well, I think there's also treble damages as well.
Yeah.
And so, this is a case where they're trying to take advantage of that generous remedy provision that they would not otherwise be entitled to under the state law claims.
RICO is a good it's a good jury case for a plaintiff because in order to show the, plurality of predicate acts, you get to bring in additional victims.
Well,
testify, then you have, three victims instead of one victim.
But, Your Honor, their allegations as to the pattern of racketeering are also deficient in their complaint. They allege very vague and conclusory allegations about two other individuals, and none of those allegations rise to the level of a Hobbs Act violation. So they have to allege more than just one Hobbs Act violation with regard to the conduct that was directed to them. Now, as I've already explained, they haven't even done that. But nor have they.
Talking about some other people, though, who had also had similar experiences.
They do. They raised two other individuals, Rand and Bosenbrooks.
Bosenbrooks, yeah,
yes. And with Bosenbrooks, they just allege that we entered into a joint venture with him with the goal of attaining his interest later on. And then with Rand, they say we entered into a joint venture with Rand and then bought out his interest for less than what he was due, less than fair market value. But for the same reasons that I've already explained, those allegations don't state a Hobbs Act violation. They have to actually allege a Hobbs Act violation with respect to the conduct that was directed to them and also with respect to Rand and Bosenbrooks. So it's not just do they happen to bring up these other individuals' names and throw them into the complaint. They have to allege two or more predicate acts under the Hobbs Act. And they haven't done that with regard to them, with regard to Rand, or with regard to Bosenbrooks. And even just alleging, let's say they did allege three Hobbs Act violations, they have to be interrelated. There has to be a threat of future harm. And they haven't satisfied those requirements either. Those are requirements in order to plead a pattern of racketeering under the RICO Act. So there are many independent grounds for affirming the dismissal of the RICO count. And I see that my time is up. Does the panel have any other questions?
No. Thank you very much, Ms. Nelson. Mr. Bates, your time had expired. You can have a minute if you have anything further you'd like to say.
Thank you, Your Honors. Very briefly, we are dealing with notice pleadings here on a case decided on a motion to dismiss under Rule 12b-6. To the extent there's discussion as to whether or not the property management agreements could be terminated with or without cause, the complaint, I believe it's paragraph 20, identifies that those documents were drafted by Mr. Rowe and his entities. To the extent there's any ambiguity, that ambiguity should be resolved against Mr. Rowe, but in any event, the ambiguity would be an issue of fact for the jury to decide. Again, we're talking about notice pleading under a 12b-6. What Ms. Nelson said about the predicate acts.
Rowe could really be sent to prison for criminal violations?
Your Honor, when we were talking about how much, you know, that she said that they calculated this is what he would be entitled to when the interest was bought out. And again, I think it's important to keep in mind that 6 months prior, they had valued that very interest. What would you get if you were bought out at $3.5 million?
Of the American business community in prison for Hobbs Act.
No, because the important distinction, Judge Posner, is that in order for there to be a Hobbs, first of all, private parties can't bring the Hobbs Act violation. Secondly, in a RICO claim, again, you have to have this.
You know, it's a crime. The government.
So they send
the government
it over
would
to
be
the
allowed
US
to
attorney.
Make an independent determination as to whether or not they want to move forward. This case also doesn't increase the amount of RICO fines because, again, you have to have the predicate act. We've alleged in our complaint that not only with regard to my client, but also with regard to Mr. Rand and Boston Brooks, that this was a pattern of activity that Green Court and the entities conducted their business. And again, this is a 12b-6 motion to dismiss.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both, counsel. Next.